wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
So this week we're starting off by talking about seabed plutonium and supernovas, and I actually heard something on BFM about this last night. They were sort of talking about these crazy particles on the bottom of the sea which can unlock the universe's secrets, from my understanding.
Maybe overstating it just a smidge.
Okay.
So, James, I've got a question. Do you know, fundamentally, do you know where you come from?
Your mother?
Yeah. Well, do you know where she comes from?
The stars.
Yeah, I guess we're made up of stuff.
Well, this is it. So the atoms in your body, do you know where they came from?
No.
Right. So scientists have long thought that, they figured out where most of the atoms in the universe probably came from. But there are a few questions remaining. So the universe began with a big bang, which was hugely energetic. It seeded the universe with atoms, but only a few of the light ones. So only really hydrogen, some helium, and then a tiny, tiny amount of lithium, the three lightest elements. And then soon after the Big Bang, a few million years after the Big Bang, atoms started to coalesce into stars. Hydrogen and helium started to fuse, and heavier elements started to be produced, up to about iron, which is element 50-something in the periodic table, iron and nickel. And so when the stars themselves exploded, they released those elements. But anything heavier than iron needed some even more extreme conditions. And astrophysicists have long thought that those only really existed in the explosions of supernova. Okay, so these massive explosions that exist, that have happened in the universe, and during certain types of supernova, the bursts of neutrons bombard the atoms, such as iron, at a rate that makes them swell into bigger elements faster than they can decay. So they just get a bunch of neutrons, makes them grow fast, and this rapid neutron capture is known as the R process, so the letter R. And that's thought to produce about half the elements heavier than iron. Now, it's all of these big supernova release all of these elements out into the universe, and they were traveling, and eventually some of them may have rained down on Earth, yeah? And like sort of snow falling, some of these heavy elements eventually incorporated themselves into rocks, which stayed there, and eventually they may have been dug up and we can find them again. And we can tell that they are elements that came from supernova because they will be radioactive, but they have short half-lives that are shorter than the Earth's lifetime. In other words, if they had been created when Earth was formed, they would have long since disappeared. Yeah, so these things must have arrived since our planet was formed. Yeah, and the only source is outer space. And so our planet formed about 4.5 billion years ago, and so elements that with a much shorter half-life, in other words, that's the measure of the lifetime of that element. If that lifetime is much, much shorter, then those elements would have disappeared completely had they been formed here. So one of the elements that the scientists look for is iron. It's called iron-60, which is a radioactive form of iron. And that's got a half-life of about 2.6 million years, which is still a long time, but short when you compare it to the lifetime, the age of this planet. And looking at rocks from certain types of rocks from the ocean floor, a couple of teams in 2016 published results that suggest that nearby supernova dusted Earth with iron-60 between about 2 and 3 million years ago, and then maybe again or even earlier around about 5 million years ago. So the supernova within the vicinity of this planet dusted the Earth, and we can see the remains of those elements. There's also another element, plutonium, which is plutonium-244, which has a lifetime of about 80 or so million years, And several groups have looked at plutonium in the ocean. And by looking at the relative amount of plutonium and iron, they can start to suggest exactly how these elements were formed. So supernova, big explosions of stars, is one way that these things could form. But astrophysicists have thought about different possible ways that these elements could form. And another one is when big neutron stars, these are stars that are incredibly dense, merge together and go bang with a lot of power, create a lot of elements. And so this is another way to form these elements. And different mechanisms will give you different ratios of these elements. And so a recent study using what's called a mass spectrometer, which essentially weighs atoms at ANU in Australia, which has very, very high sensitivity, revealed that supernova probably dusted the Earth with iron again about 2.5 and again at 6 million years ago. And that confirms the picture of what they had before. But they also detected 181 atoms of plutonium. Now, atoms are tiny. 181 is not very many. But that was enough to looking at the ratios, to say that the amount of these elements that came from supernova is a lot smaller than they expected. And neutron stars actually make up a decent proportion of what we actually see. So just by looking at the ratios of these elements, very, very few atoms in a sizable sample, you can actually start to say, to learn about these cosmic processes that happened, you know, millions and millions of years ago. And so by recovering more debris, they hope to learn more about where these elements came from. And this starts to offer clues of the type of explosions that actually seeded the solar system, that actually gave rise to the elements that created ultimately the solar system that we live in. And it would also be a hint, if you're lucky enough, as to whether the gold in the ring of your finger, and the ring on your finger, comes from the explosion of a dying star, or from the cataclysmic melding of two unimaginably dense balls of neutron matter.
That's insane.
That's also fantastic, because we were literally talking about that this morning. Where does gold come from?
Okay, that's weird.
That's so weird. I really hope Jemima's listening. That's all of her questions answered.
Yeah, so one of the two, but more from neutron stars than we expected.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, looking at our next topic, we're talking about quasi-crystals and nuclear bombs. I don't even know what a quasi-crystal is.
Okay. Do you know what a regular crystal is?
It's like an atom structure.
Everything's an atom structure.
Molecule structure, which is very rigid and stuff.
Not quite. So if table salt, for example, is an example of just a regular crystal, and it contains sodium and chlorine ions, charged atoms, that form a regular repeating pattern. So in salt, sodium chloride, it's a cubic pattern, so you can imagine lots of cubes stacked on top of each other. And if you look anywhere in that structure, it basically looks the same. Yeah, you've just got this regular lattice. Quasicrystals were proposed only a few decades ago, and then only discovered more recently. And these are crystals that contain atoms that, unlike those in ordinary crystals, do not repeat in a regular sort of brickwork-like pattern. So wherever you look in the crystal, it looks a little bit different. So it's in a normal crystal, if you translate the crystal, if you move it in a certain direction, they look the same. Yeah. But quasar crystals, if you do the same, they look different. And an example of this is in two dimensions. If you've ever seen, so if you can look online for this. So Roger Penrose, who's a famous mathematician, invented or discovered two-dimensional patterns that fill space. They tile like floor tiling, but they don't repeat. So if you look at floor tiling, we've got tiles on sort of carpet tiles on the floor here, and you can see they're squares and they sort of repeat in a predictable way. But these two-dimensional tiles that Penrose discovered actually don't repeat in the same way. So if you look at anywhere in this pattern, it looks different. Okay, and that's the two-dimensional version of these three-dimensional quasi-crystals. Anywhere in this structure, this repeating pattern, it doesn't repeat.
This is so confusing.
Which is weird.
This is so confusing because to me, you're saying that this is a pattern that isn't actually a pattern.
Yes.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Go online and look at, search Penrose tiling.
I will, and
you'll sort of see an example of this, at least in two dimensions. Yeah.
So how does a nuclear bomb come into this?
Well, that's a good question. So these quasi-crystals, were proposed and then discovered in some synthetic alloys in the early 80s. And this guy, Daniel Shechtman, who discovered these things, ultimately won the Nobel Prize for that discovery in 2011. And around the same time, a theoretical physicist who's now at Princeton theorized the possibility of the existence of non-repeating three-dimensional structures. And these have the same symmetry as an icosahedron. So these are things with a five-fold symmetry. So if you know what a soccer ball looks like, that sort of icosahedral symmetry. But these are not space-filling structures. They don't tile in the same way as, say, a cube would tile in three dimensions. Okay, and so they started discovering crystals not in nature, but in some materials that they found from meteorites in eastern Siberia. They also were able to make them in the lab, but produced by sort of smashing materials together at high speed. So these things were formed by very, very energetic processes and not things that would normally happen, you know, just in the general environment. And so now we get to nuclear weapons. So the first atom bomb test in New Mexico was called the Trinity Test, and that was the first ever detonation of a nuclear bomb. And it took place in 1945, and it was on the top of a sort of a tower, a 30-meter-high tower, which was laden with sensors and cables and all sorts of things. And when this thing had gone off and they came back and looked at the debris, they found a material which they called trinitite, after the Trinity Test sort of bomb. And it had sort of these reddish sort of inclusions. And this was because of the copper wiring that had been sort of around the tower had formed alloys with the other material there, lots of silicon and other materials that were in the environment. And they formed these different sort of crystals and minerals. This is obviously a high energy event that happened. And looking closely, they started to find these quasi-crystals. More recently, they looked closely and they started to find these quasi-crystals. And looking very, very closely, this is Professor Steinhardt, the Nobel Prize winner, looking very closely at these materials, they found tiny grains that had the same sort of icosahedral as in some of the earlier discoveries. So these were quasi-crystals not found in nature normally, but they were produced after the atom bomb test. And the structure is extremely interesting. They seem to be made of atoms that are not in their normal environments. Lots of silicon, lots of copper in these things. And so the question is, what's the point? Why are we interested? Well, the idea is that the existence of these crystals could be used for as a sort of a kind of nuclear forensic science, because they might reveal sites where any covert nuclear tests have occurred. These high, lots of energy could make these sort of quasi-crystals. And so quasi-crystals might also form in materials that were generated in violent conditions, such as fulgurite, which is the material made when lightning strikes rock. So there could be evidence of those there as well. So this is a sort of a topic of interest. I don't know if it's got lots of industrial applications or anything like that, but it's just an interesting idea.
Yeah, and just because we need to get on with the rest of the show, quickly talk about this tissue?
Very quickly. So obviously we're in the midst of a pandemic, but about 100 years ago there was another pandemic, a flu pandemic, and very little, until recently, very little had been done to actually look at the genome of these flu viruses, because there wasn't many samples. So more recently, they have started to look at, because we've gotten really good at analyzing the DNA and the RNA of viruses since the pandemic, And so recently, researchers managed to sequence large parts of the virus of two men, one aged 18 and the other 17, who died in Berlin in 1918 from a new influenza strain that had emerged earlier that year. And then later on, they found some a sample from a woman in Austria, and were able to get some samples from that, which also showed this strain. And they think what happened in 1918, 1919 is that there were two waves of this pandemic. The first wave was relatively mild. The second wave was much more severe. As we're seeing with COVID, we're seeing different strains come through. And to try and cut a long story short, so they were looking for signs in the genome of this virus as to why this first strain was not as virulent as the second. And what they found was that mutations in the gene that help the influenza avoid the human body's antiviral defenses were more bird-like in the early virus and more human-like in the later strain. So there were mutations in basically the parts of the virus that helped it sort of evade human defenses that had mutated from strain to strain and causing the second strain to be much more virulent.
That's crazy. Well, you should be glad to know that you've made someone's head hurt with all your quasi crystals talk.
Go and look at Penrose tiling.
I think you've made my head hurt as well, just a little bit. Thank you so much, Marcus, and we'll see you in another 2 weeks.
You certainly will.
Sweet ass.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow. Sweet.